From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, Randall Keynes, about how the death of Darwin's 10-year-old daughter affected Darwin's thinking about evolution, religion, and human nature. Darwin became an agnostic while his wife continued to go to church and believe in an afterlife that she feared her husband would not be part of. Keynes' book, Creation, has been adapted into a new movie. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers Senator Harry Reid's comments about Obama's electability and what the responses to those comments say about American racial attitudes. And critic at large John Powers recommends the retro spy series Burn Notice, which begins new episodes tonight on the USA Network. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, my guest Randall Keynes, is the author of a book about how the death of Darwin's 10-year-old daughter Annie affected Darwin's thinking about evolution, religion, and human nature. And that's what we're going to talk about. That book has just been adapted into a new film starring Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly. The book, which was originally titled Darwin, His Daughter, and Human Evolution, has been published in a new edition with the same title as the film, Creation. My guest Randall Keynes is not only related to Darwin, he's the great-nephew of economist John Maynard Keynes. His book Creation is based on Darwin family papers, manuscripts in the Darwin Archive, as well as the memoirs and letters published after Darwin and his wife Emma died. Keynes' book begins in 1838, just before Darwin got married. This was a couple of years after his five-year voyage on the HMS Beagle, sailing around the world as the ship's naturalist. His observations on that trip led to his first book. Randall Keynes, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book had me at the very first paragraph, and it's about the quandary that Darwin was in deciding whether to marry or not. I'd like you to read that paragraph.
When, at 29, Charles Darwin thought about marrying, he took a piece of paper and wrote, "This is the question." Under "not marry," he jotted down, "freedom to go where one liked, choice of society and little of it, conversation of clever men at clubs, not forced to visit relatives and to bend in every trifle, to have the expense and anxiety of children, perhaps quarrelling, loss of time. How should I manage all my business if I were obliged to go every day walking with my wife? Ehew, I never should know French, or see the continent, or go to America, or go up in a balloon." Under "marry," he wrote, "children, if it please God, constant companion and friend in old age, who will feel interested in one." He weighed up the points for and against, and made up his mind. "My God, it is intolerable to think of spending one's whole life like a neuter bee, working, working, and nothing after all. No, no, won't do. Imagine living all one's day solitarily in smoky, dirty London house. Only picture to yourself a nice, soft wife on a sofa with a good fire and books and music, perhaps. Marry, 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 QED.
You know, this outside of a slight touch of sexism there, it's such a contemporary way of thinking about marriage. You know, everybody wants to balance work and family. Everybody's having trouble doing it. And here's Darwin trying to figure out how to do it in the 1800s.
Yes.
And I thought,
and Darwin writes it all out.
Yeah, and he writes it all out. So he did marry. He had it sounds like he had a really good relationship with his wife, a very intelligent woman. He loved his children and even was doing like a natural history of babies. Why was he studying his babies?
He was studying his babies because before he married, he had realized that humans might be cousins to the great apes and the whole of the animal kingdom, if this idea that he had found that species might change turned out to be true. And he started by looking at an orangutan, a young orangutan that was brought to London Zoo, and seeing how like a human she was by giving her things to play with and watching what she did and watching how she responded to his comments and remarks and so on. When he married, for the first time he was able to experiment with an infant to see whether the infant behaved in similar ways. And he did this first with Annie's elder brother, and then 2 years later as a scientist, just to check that this was a regular pattern of behavior with infants, he repeated all the little experiments with Annie, and she did what her brother did. They were both doing very much the same thing as the orangutan was doing, and this to him was very important confirmation of the closeness of the link between human and animal.
So what were they doing in common, the infants and the orangutan?
they were responding to expressions, smiles and fierce expressions. They were showing an interest in objects given to them. And one point that was particularly interesting was how the orangutan and then the infant responded when it saw its reflection in a little hand mirror. Darwin noticed that this little orangutan put her hand behind the mirror to see if she could see, touch this thing that she could see in the mirror, to see whether it was there. And Annie didn't do that, from which he concluded that on that comparison, the ape was more intelligent than his loved child.
How did he get access to an orangutan? You describe in your book about how monkeys, apes were basically unknown in England and Europe.
Yes.
At the time that Darwin was beginning his work.
Yes, there's a great irony about this, because they were unknown, because all that were brought, as a number had been, from Africa and from Asia, caught very quickly the human diseases that they were subject to because they were so close to us. So a number had been brought, but they had all died almost immediately on arrival in England. Jenny the orang was brought from Asia in 1838 and was taken to London Zoo and was put on show in London Zoo. When Darwin heard that this extraordinary creature was there, this animal that was so close to a human, he went along with his notebook and with a little hand mirror and a harmonica and I think some peppermints to see if the creature liked peppermints. Points like that. And he spoke to the keeper of the orangutan and was allowed to go into the cage and play with her, which he did. And then he made notes of everything that happened. And those were his basis for the comparison with his children when he was able to play the same games with them.
One of the things I find so fascinating about your book, Creation, is your discussion of Charles Darwin's changing beliefs about religion as he got deeper into his scientific pursuit of evolution. What were his religious beliefs before he started to create the theory of evolution?
When he was on the voyage of the Beagle, which took 5 years, immediately after he left university, he spent these 5 years travelling around the world, seeing so much and picking up the clues to the possibility that species might change. At that time, his beliefs were entirely orthodox. He was a loyal and orthodox young Christian gentleman. I think that's how he would have seen himself. He believed that the first chapter of Genesis was a literal account of the creation of the world and then of life and then of humans. With his realization of the possibility that species might change, he started questioning his own beliefs. He asked, what is this based on? How does this idea that I have that species might change compare with the Bible's account of God creating all the different kinds of animal in the Garden of Eden? He questioned the biblical account. He went on questioning. He asked himself, why should I believe the biblical account alongside what I can see and work out from what I see around me? And he grew increasingly uncertain that he should and could believe the biblical account.
My guest is Randall Keynes, and he's the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, and we're talking about his book Creation, The True Story of Charles Darwin. This book is the basis of a new film called Creation. Let's talk a little bit more about Darwin and religion. He was brought up as a Unitarian. His wife, Emma, was a very devout Unitarian. What did it mean to be a Unitarian for his wife, Emma?
The Unitarians had one point of doctrine on which they differed from the Church of England, and that had to do with the Trinity. They felt that God was one, and that Christ was a mortal who had pointed the way towards faith in God. Emma was a devout Unitarian. She wasn't, as many people believe, a dogmatic and certain Christian. What she felt, and this was a feature for many Unitarians, was that faith was all important, and the commitment to faith was the important commitment of religion.
You write that one of the reasons why Darwin started to challenge Genesis is he learned about the vastness of geological time.
Yes.
And that led him to question the historical parts of the Hebrew Bible.
That's absolutely right. And he always lived with the Bible, and he knew all the parts that everyone else knew very well. He thought about them. He found himself increasingly uncertain whether they could be a true and accurate account of everything they claimed to be.
You write that at some point Darwin thought that his theory of evolution accounted for cruelty and pain better, or at least differently, than the Christian faith did. What did evolution have to say about cruelty and pain?
He didn't feel that his theory explained cruelty and pain. He simply suggested that there might not be any explanation of cruelty and pain like the ones offered in the Christian faith that had to do with punishment, reward, and so on and so forth. His idea was that you shouldn't be looking for explanations of cruelty and pain in what happens to people during their lives and into their death.
That there's no reason for it.
There's no
ordained reason for it.
Yes, that God isn't up there engineering events for any reasons to do with how we conduct our lives.
My guest is Randall Keynes. He's Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson and author of the book Creation, The True Story of Charles Darwin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Randall Keynes. He's a great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, and he's written a book called Creation, The True Story of Charles Darwin, and the book has been adapted into a film which is called Creation. And it stars Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly. Some of your book revolves around Charles and Emma Darwin's daughter Annie. It was their first daughter, and she died at the age of 10. After suffering some pretty severe symptoms, what were her symptoms?
She became restless and ill at ease when she was 9. It was clear that she wasn't well, and nobody could say what was wrong with her. She was taken for a cure for this illness, unknown illness, and while she was at the spa where she was being treated with a form of water treatment, water therapy, to avoid medicines that many people at the time felt were poisons, not medicines, and in fact they were poisons, not medicines. While she was at the spa being given this treatment, she developed a fever, and the fever killed her in a fortnight.
One of the many parts of the story of Charles Darwin, as you tell it, that has very contemporary resonance is that, the Darwin sought out alternative therapies for their daughter Annie when she was sick. So many people seek out now. Let's talk a little bit about what the alternative therapies of the time were. You mentioned water therapy. What was that therapy?
Yes, this was a very important point I found in the story. And it all stemmed from the almost hopeless inadequacy of most medicine at the time. The medicine that was taught in the medical schools, most of it was pretty useless, and much of it was based on no proven efficacy of the medicine being used. Many of the medicines were actually toxic because the doctors had no idea of the effects of continuing to dose a child with mercury or other compounds that they were...
Yeah, strychnine is one of the things that you mentioned.
Yes, yes. So a person like Darwin wanted to find a treatment that he could be confident would work. And the water treatment was offered by a doctor who hated the medicines and could see how noxious they were to many people that they were given to, and the other things like bleeding and so on. This doctor formed an idea of how water might be able to help many conditions, and he devised a set of treatments and he offered them to people, and they were found by many people to be effective. And Darwin found them to be effective, and we have his notes of his treatment to show that for him they were effective.
And he had a lot of problems too, very severe digestive
problems. He was chronically ill himself with digestive problems, with skin conditions, and he found empirically that this treatment was effective, and he therefore, when the doctors couldn't cure Annie of her lingering malaise, he took her to the spa to see if the water doctor's treatment might help.
And the water treatment was what? You were wrapped in sheets of water?
Yes, in very wet sheets?
It
was an alternation of hot water and cold water, shivering and sweating. You were wrapped in towels, you were... water was thrown over you. You lay in a warm room with one treatment was heating by the lamp when you were encouraged to sweat. And it was based on a theory of how the body worked. The theory doesn't stand up now. Treatments of that kind.
When Annie, the Darwin's daughter, died at the age of 10, the Darwins were devastated. You write that Emma hoped that Annie would go to heaven and that eventually Emma would be able to join her there. But on the other hand, after Annie's death, Charles gave up the Christian faith. He didn't attend church services with the family. He walked them to the church door, but didn't go in. Why was Annie's death a turning point for him in terms of his faith?
I have to say that I don't think Annie's death was a turning point in the sense that he wouldn't have made that turning if she had recovered and got better. It's clear that he was on a path through the years before of increasing doubt about the Christian faith. And it's clear that in the year after her death, he was no longer going to church. He would go with his family to the church. They would go in. He would go away and walk around in the countryside until they came out. Annie's death was just part of this long letting go of the faith that he had been brought up with.
You write that Darwin still believed in a divine creator, but not in his infinite goodness. What were you able to glean about what Darwin's conception of God was after...
Darwin thought long and hard about who, what God might be, what his purposes might be, what his plans for humans and all of that might be. He just couldn't form a clear picture. He worried, worried, and worried at all the questions that others were also asking themselves. He never gave up. We know that from some comments he made right at the end of his life, where he was clearly still worrying about these questions. He just couldn't decide. He couldn't see anything clear in one area or another that helped him to form a picture.
How did Annie's death fit into his thinking about the survival of the fittest and the death of the weak?
Annie's death showed him so clearly that this couldn't be anything other than a natural process. It couldn't have anything to do with the moral actions, deserts, whatever, of the child in question, the adult in question. It had just to be the outcome of some natural process, the catching of a disease, an accident, or whatever.
Randall Keynes will be back in the second half of the show. He's the author of Creation, the true story of Charles Darwin, which has just been adapted into a new film of the same name, Creation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Booz Allen Hamilton, strategy and technology consultants at boozallen.com. And from Sci-Fi, presenting Caprica, an original series starring Eric Stoltz, Friday, January 22nd at 9, 8 Central on Sci-Fi. This is NPR.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers Senator Harry Reid's much-quoted comments about Barack Obama's electability and what reactions to those comments reveal about American racial attitudes. Also, John Powers recommends the retro spy series Burn Notice, which begins new episodes tonight, and we continue our conversation about Charles Darwin with his great-great-grandson, Randall Keynes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, Randall Keynes. Keynes is the author of the book Creation, about how the death of Darwin's 10-year-old daughter Annie in 1851 affected Darwin's thinking on evolution, religion, and human nature. The new movie Creation, starring Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly, is adapted from Keynes' book, which was originally titled Darwin, His Daughter, and Human Evolution. Darwin published his now famous book, Origin of the Species, in 1859. He knew it was going to be controversial. And then that was 8 years after his daughter Annie's death. He published Descent of Man in 1871. You've researched what reaction was to Darwin's theories in his own time. Now, those theories are still controversial, probably more so in the United States than in England, where you live. But tell us a little bit about what reaction was like to his books in his own time.
When The Origin of Species was published in 1859, the reaction by most respectable commentators was fiercely hostile. In a few years, people had come to see that it didn't actually threaten religion in the ways that the first critics had claimed that it did, and I think creationists still do. And there was much greater acceptance of the basic idea that he offered in The Origin of Species, that species have a history of change, all species, including our own. He published The Descent of Man partly because he felt that the Victorian age, the world was now ready for the second part of his theory, because it had been accepted enough for it to have a reasonable hearing. And Darwin ended up being buried in Westminster Abbey when he died. That was a mark of how his ideas had been accepted as worth thinking about, not rejected out of hand, in the 23 years, I think, between the publication of The Origin and his death.
Was the most controversial part in his time the theory that man evolved from apes?
It's quite clear, I think, that that was the point that really rattled people. Not that we evolved from apes, but that we are close cousins of them, and that there is something animal at the heart of human nature. That was shocking to most people, and it was so important for Darwin that we should face up to that, because while some of the implications were bad for us, some were good for us and for animals, and he wanted everyone to understand the good things about our common nature with animals, as well as the bad things.
In Darwin's time, was his theory of evolution seen as a rejection of Genesis and therefore a rejection of religion?
Some people who wanted to reject the Bible argued that it was, and took it as a text for atheism. Darwin was very unhappy for the argument to be used in that way. He wouldn't associate himself with attacks like that, uses like that of his argument. It was very important to him that many Christians felt that there was no contradiction between readings of his theory and the revelation, the faith that was so important to them. Very soon after the first edition of The Origin of Species appeared, a prominent Christian commentator wrote to him saying he welcomed Darwin's theory, there was a great deal of interest in it, and he saw no direct contradiction between his theory and the teachings of Christianity. Darwin was so pleased with that statement. He couldn't go along with the signing up to faith himself, but he was so pleased with that other people found no contradiction that he put that statement into the second edition of the book. And when the book was published again a month after the first publication, that statement by this commentator, who was called Charles Kingsley, appears and shows that Darwin wanted his theory to be seen to be consistent with Christianity.
Charles Darwin's wife, Emma, believed in an afterlife and hoped that in that afterlife she would be united with her husband, with Annie, her 10-year-old daughter who died. Darwin gave up faith in an afterlife. And I just try to imagine what it was like for Emma, wanting to be united in the afterlife with her family, knowing that her husband didn't even believe in it, and that he felt very strongly about the reasons why. I mean, there were scientific reasons for it, too. I mean, he was able to reason out loud why he didn't believe in it. How much do you think that that divided Emma and Charles during their marriage? How much do you think it hurt Emma to think that her husband didn't believe in it?
It hurt her very greatly. It's quite clear from a number of letters that survive in which she tried to explain to him why she so wished that he could believe in God and the Christian revelation. She believed that faith in God might be a condition for entry into heaven in the afterlife. She felt that through his inability to believe in God, Darwin was giving up the chance of eternal happiness in the afterlife with her. She was going to miss him. These were intense and deep beliefs of hers, and the tragedy for them was that he could do nothing about his doubts, and she could do nothing about her fear that with his doubts he was ruling out for them the possibility of eternal happiness in the afterlife.
My guest is Randall Kainz. He's Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson and author of the book Creation, The True Story of Charles Darwin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Kainz, and he's the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. We're talking about his book, Creation, The True Story of Charles Darwin. That book has been adapted into a movie that stars Paul Bettany as Darwin and Jennifer Connelly as his wife, Emma. You're in the United States right now. As we record this, you've been here a few days. You've been talking about the book. You've been taking questions from people. I think those are different. I think the England where you're from is kind of different than the United States in the sense that in the United States there's a very strong Christian creationism movement that is very uncomfortable with Darwin's theory of evolution. Some people don't even want it taught in the schools. So I'm wondering, do you feel like you have to be on your guard when you're in the United States talking about Darwin? Is it different for you to talk about Darwin here than it is in England?
It is very different because of the charge that these issues have from the fierceness of the argument in the last 10 years, I think. I'm not sure that it was so fierce before. I think it's a development of the very recent past. It's different. I am not worried by it because so many other people see the sense and value of Darwin's ideas. It's no surprise, it should be no surprise, that many people have difficulty with the implications of the theory. And I am happy that the argument continues. I'm happy that people argue against it as long as there are people arguing for it in the ways that I think Darwin would have felt were the right ways.
Are you amazed when you research Darwin's life at how he was able to come up with the theory of evolution, not knowing so much of the science that has subsequently, you know, been discovered? I mean, we know about DNA now, but he didn't know about that. Are you amazed at everything that Darwin didn't know?
Yes, it is quite extraordinary. This point about how he developed the whole theory and offered it to the world without knowing, without understanding an absolutely key part of the modern day account of the theory, which is the mechanism of inheritance and how inheritance works so that traits that have advantages through natural selection survive and develop. It shows, I think, extraordinary boldness on his part. He was so confident from the other evidence that there must be something to this theory that he offered it without this piece in the jigsaw, a theory of how inheritance worked. And it's just wonderful to see how, with Mendelian genetics and then with molecular biology, the theory has been strengthened and strengthened and strengthened and strengthened by the understanding that we've gained of these key processes.
Randall Kainz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Randall Kainz is the author of Creation, the True Story of Charles Darwin, which has been adapted into a new film called Creation, starring Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly. The media have spent the last few weeks chewing over the revelation in the book Game Change that Senator Harry Reid said privately that Barack Obama would be acceptable to the electorate because he was light-skinned and had no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. According to our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, the responses to Reid's remarks say a lot more about American racial attitudes than Reid himself did.
Just about everybody thought Harry Reid needed to apologize, including Reid himself. But why? You couldn't fault the actual content of the remark, that an African-American presidential candidate has a better chance of being elected if he doesn't look or sound too black. That may be a deplorable reality, but it's not controversial. Even George Will gave Reid a pass. As he put it on ABC's This Week, at long last, Harry Reid has said something that no one can disagree with, and he gets in trouble for it. But according to Liz Cheney, it still shouldn't have been said. She shot back at Will, "Give me a break, George. I mean, talking about the color of the president's skin, it's not the way that people that I know speak to each other." Actually, I can believe that about Cheney's circle. There are a lot of people nowadays who think of skin color as like a piece of lettuce caught in somebody's teeth. You should really try not to see it, and if you do, it's unseemly to bring it up. Reid's use of Negro stirred a similar sense of unease. In the Washington Post, Ezra Klein called it weird, and others went with awkward, unfortunate, or dumb. President Obama called it inartful, which was a deft way of implying that the lapse was purely stylistic. And some called it a racist slur, confusing outmoded with outrageous. But it's never been that. If Negro really were a slur, many older blacks wouldn't still be claiming it as their primary racial identification, and whites wouldn't feel so comfortable about repeating it. Still, the word does have what the African-American linguist John McWhorter called a tangy backwards flavor. And it can certainly be tinged with sarcasm, depending who's using it. Spike Lee coined the term magical Negro as a dig at condescending racial stereotypes in Hollywood films. And the tang was a little more pungent when Rush Limbaugh was playing a record of a white Al Sharpton imitator singing a song called Barack the Magic Negro during the 2008 campaign. But in Reid's mouth, Negro wasn't condescending or contemptuous, just clueless. To be fair, Reid may not use the word except in talking about language. His reference to Negro dialect may have been a garbled version of non-standard Negro English, the term scholars were using for black English until well into the 1970s. And the man isn't exactly stylin'. If he hasn't changed his racial vocabulary since Jimmy Carter was president, he hasn't changed his eyeglass frames either. But over a quarter century in Congress, he probably should have gotten out a little more. But even if we couldn't agree about its severity, Reid's offense clearly fell under the capacious heading of racial insensitivity. That phrase was introduced in the 1970s to broaden the range of conversational infractions. Even if you weren't an unregenerate Archie Bunker-style bigot, you could still be held accountable for merely being obtuse about race. But the phrase also turned out to be a useful way of enabling out-and-out racism to cop to a lesser plea. In fact, journalists almost never describe any remark as racist anymore. For the New York Times, there was racial insensitivity in Don Imus' reference to nappy-headed hoes, and the L.A. Times heard it in Michael Richards' nightclub tirade. And back in September, National Review's Jonah Goldberg conceded that there was some racial insensitivity in a few of the signs at the Tea Party protests, which included slogans like Save White America and depictions of Obama as a witch doctor with a bone through his nose. The implication was presumably that those protesters could have tried to express themselves more artfully. As the media used the term, racial insensitivity blurs the distinction between one N-word and another, or between Michael Steele's use of Honest Injun and Trent Lott's suggestion that the country would have had fewer problems if we'd elected a segregationist as president in 1948. Whether those offenses are venial or mortal, malign or merely thoughtless, by the time they get to YouTube, they're all just gaucheries and gaffes, and they all require the same formulaic apology. Yet almost nobody called Reed to task on the one item that really did betray a deep-seated social prejudice, that word dialect. Of course, as linguists use the word, everybody speaks one dialect or another, Tracy Morgan and Patrick Stewart, Loretta Lynn and Diane Sawyer. But most people reserve the word dialect for varieties of language that are seen as expressive and colorful, but illogical and illiterate. Linguists have been pointing out for a very long time that those varieties all turn out to have a complicated and systematic structure of their own. But it's hard not to hear them through stereotypes of race and class. It's striking how many of the things people say in public about Black English are the same things they'd no longer allow themselves to say about the people who speak it. It's slovenly, lazy, ignorant, stupid, broken. Those stereotypes haven't really disappeared from public life. They've just been repurposed as attitudes about language. Everybody likes to invoke Martin Luther King's dream of a nation where no one's judged by the color of his skin. But most people are fine with judging somebody by the shape of his vowels.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Jeff recently sent me a CD by a country singer he really likes, who I'd never heard of, but I'm sure glad I know him now. He's Vern Gosden, who died last year. So now I want to play a track for you. This is Chiseled in Stone.
You ran crying to the bedroom. I ran off to the bar. Another piece of heaven gone to hell. The words we spoke in anger just tore my world apart. And I sit there feeling sorry for myself. Then an old man sat down beside me and looked me in the eye. And he said, son, I know what you're going through. You ought to get down on your knees and thank your lucky stars that you got someone to go home to. You don't know about
That's Vern Gosden. Coming up, our critic at large, John Powers, recommends a TV series he thinks you may not even be aware of. This is Fresh Air. Our critic at large, John Powers, spends his time watching lots of movies and reading lots of books, but sometimes he just wants to veg out in front of the TV. And that's where he'll be tonight when Burn Notice returns on the USA Network.
You often hear the 50s called the golden age of television. If so, we're deep into the platinum age. There have never been more sophisticated shows, from ambitious dramas like Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and Big Love, to delirious conceptual series like 24, Lost, and Flash Forward. But it's also a very good period for disposable TV shows of the kind I grew up with. You know, the ones that you turn on when you're tired, and that nobody ever writes op-ed pieces about. My favorite is Burn Notice, a jaunty, self-consciously retro spying and caper series with roots in the Rockford Files and Mission Impossible. Jeffrey Donovan stars as Michael Weston, a CIA man who's been bounced from the agency and winds up in his hometown of Miami. There he hooks up with a crew of sidekicks. His gun-happy girlfriend Fiona, that's Gabrielle Anwar, a beer-guzzling ex-spook Sam Axe, amiably played by Bruce Campbell, who you might remember from Sam Raimi's Evil Dead movies. And then there's his mother Madeline, a hard-smoking hypochondriac played with blousy brio by Sharon Gless, who sometimes helps out, when not giving Michael grief for getting into trouble. He's constantly doing just that. You see, Michael loved being a spy. He thought he was doing good, and he's eager to get back into the company. But as he struggles to do this, he keeps afloat by helping innocent people with their problems. Every week, he and his pals run ops against extortionists or murderers or kidnappers from the Russian mob. In the new episode, for instance, he helps a woman threatened by insurance fraudsters by pretending to be a tobacco-chewing hot rodder from the Tar Heel State. It's part of the show's charm that as Michael does his thing, he's constantly talking to us, explaining the ins and outs of spycraft. Here, he's just received a mysterious message inviting him to meet somebody up in a hotel room.
In the world of espionage, there are a lot of ways to introduce yourself. You can use official channels, you can use a cover ID, you can use encrypted communication. Whatever the method, that first contact tells you a lot about a person. Especially when someone introduces himself by firebombing a hotel room.
Burn Notice was created by Matt Nix, who's clearly wised up about old TV. In this episode, for example, Michael's mom gets involved with a character played by Tyne Daly, making for a nostalgic reunion of Cagney and Lacey. Like most showrunners on the USA Network, Nix keeps things fast and light, with lots of shots of sun-spanked Miami, lots of chicks in bikinis, and lots of jokey little intertitles. Of course, for a show like this to succeed, you need a hero you like spending time with, someone like Jim Rockford or Thomas Magnum, played by an actor you enjoy. While the slim, charismatic Donovan doesn't reach the transcendent stature of James Garner, perhaps the greatest TV actor of all time, he's really fun to watch. He's got terrific energy, a nice comic deadpan, and he doesn't overplay quirks like Michael's fondness for yogurt. He's constantly doing accents, and though nobody would confuse his ear with Meryl Streep's, he's good enough to keep the action perking right along. For all its old-school charm, though, Burn Notice is not a pure throwback. It's far less shambly than the Rockford Files. Shows today just have to move faster. And it's clearly been influenced by today's long-form TV dramas. Even as each episode is self-contained, each season has an arc. Last year's had a very clever plotline in which Michael got ensnared by a slippery business agent. The guy managed star spies as if they were actors or quarterbacks. The current run begins with Michael being pursued by the mystery man who torched that hotel room. Now, I should warn you, the first time you watch Burn Notice, you won't be wowed. I wasn't. The show's designed not to dazzle you, but to grow on you. And it does. Oddly enough, it even seems to be growing on itself. Since the show began in June 2007, it started to deepen, so that Michael must directly confront the question of whether it's okay to hurt innocent people to help a bigger cause. The show keeps getting better and more ambitious. Yet, strangely enough, I hope it doesn't get too much better. The real charm of Burn Notice is that it entertains you without trying to be some sort of stylistic touchstone, rumination on CIA morality, or grand statement about the zeitgeist. In fact, what makes the show great is that, like the classic shows of the past, it's content to simply be good.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large, film critic for Vogue, and writes the Absolute Powers column for Vogue.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
I eat dinner at the kitchen table. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview and performance with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Songwriter and singer Kate McGarrigle died Monday at the age of 63. She was the mother of singers Rufus and Martha Wainwright. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
No more salt when the hunger stops.